Welcome to Entrepreneurs the Playbook. I'm David Meltzer, and I have a treat for you. It's very rare we get the wisdom and the faith of somebody who has done it himself, a billionaire entrepreneur, best known as the founder of Magna International, one of the world's largest automobile part suppliers in the world. We are blessed to have on the Playbook, Frank Stronach. Welcome to the Playbook.
It's great to be with you.
Great to have you. Well, you know, there are no overnight successes, and you have definitely learned some lessons around the way. I was curious, you know, being born in 1932, how did things exponentially grow? Give us a little bit of a background when you started from your modest beginnings as an immigrant to being a billionaire today.
So you mentioned my birthday, 1932. So that means I'm 94 years young. Okay. So anyway, life is a question of fate and circumstances, being at the right places at the right time with the right ingredients. I've seen a lot during, I was born in Austria. So I have, as a kid, I witnessed the war, right? And in hindsight, you think, how can a system like the Nazi regime have a build-up and existed, right? So, and then I was born kind of in the eastern part of Austria. And at the same time, shortly after the war, we were occupied by the Russians. So I was exposed to the communistic system, right? Okay, so when I was 22, I wanted to see the world, and so I took a ticket from the cheapest fare from Holland to Canada, right? I applied for a visa to South Africa, Australia, the United States, and Canada. Canada came first through with the visa. And sometimes a little tough on the Canadian bureaucracy, but I'm saying they're the best because they came first through with a visa. So when I arrived in 1954 in Toronto, I didn't know anybody. I had $200 in my pocket, and I'm a tool and die maker by trade. And so I found a job relative quick in a small company, about 10 employees. After a few months, the owner said, "Frank, you're doing a great job. I want you to be a partner of mine." My chest swelled a bit, and I felt good, but he was a nice man. He never wrote it down. And after a while, I said to myself, this is nothing to run a business. So I looked in the papers, I found the job, I got paid double the money, and I saved everybody as much as I could. So I rented a small room, you know, the toilet and the showers were out in the hallway. And so by 1957, 3 years later, I had $5,000 saved up. $5,000 in 1957, you could buy a house or a small farm. I rented a garage type building, you know, like a four car garage, and bought a number of used machines on the down payment, and out I went hustling. I worked in a factory, and they said, "I'm very good at solving problems. If I can't solve the problems, they don't have to pay me." Obviously, I solved problems because after 1 month, I hired an employee. After one year, I had 10 employees. After 2 years, 20. And then the first evolution sets in. In life, you go to evolutionary processes, especially in business. So after 2 years, when I had 20 employees, I noticed my foreman was a little different. He was a German fellow by the name of Hermann. So I said, "Hermann, what's the matter with you lately?" So he said, "Frank, I wanted to talk to you anyway. I want to start my own business." I said, "I can sympathize with that." I said, "Look, let's talk tomorrow. Maybe we find a better answer." So that evening I was talking to myself. If that foreman's going to leave me, that would stifle my growth. No good for me. The next reason was, if that foreman's going to leave me, I got to do the work on myself. I liked it even less. The third reason was, if I hire a new foreman and I don't show him how a business is run, I still got to do all the work. And so, and if I hire a new foreman, I show him how business is run. After 1 or 2 years, again, he would start his own business and would leave me. Let's make a long story short. The next day, I met with Herman. I said, Herman, why don't we start a new factory? You want 1/3, I own 2/3. Herman said, do you mean it? I said, yes. We went right away to a lawyer, wrote it down, and Herman worked like crazy. That was his factory, right? It didn't take us long to build the factory, and so he worked. So for the next 5 years, I took 6 more foremen under similar circumstances, right? After 5 years, I had a huge amount of cash flow, right? And just things were humming and made lots and lots of money. And then I became kind of philosophical or sentimental. You know, I remember times when I was hungry. Hungry not because I wanted to lose weight. I was hungry, I had no money to buy food. So when he experienced things like that, that never leaves you. So anyway, the next day, so I had this huge cash flow, about $100 million at that time, you know. That's like a
billion. What year was that? $100 million in what year?
And after 8 years, right? Wow. I started in 57. So in 67, I did about $100 million, right? And I built the company. So I got philosophical and I said, at this time, only the managers, participated in profit sharing. Oh, okay. So I said, gee, I got to do something where also employees could participate in profit sharing. So I changed the private companies to public companies. And after 2 or 3 years, I put in a corporate constitution or corporate charter of rights. The foremost principle was I predetermined what we do with the profits. So 20% of the profits went to the shareholders. 10% of the profits went to the workers over and above their wages. 6% of the profits went to the managers. 7% was set aside for research. Research is the foundation for the future. And 2% went to charity. When I put in this program, after 1 year, our profits climbed 40%. Mm. Second year, 100%. The third year, 200%. The message I want to get across is, if you let workers share in the profits, you release an energy of untold proportions, right? Because they're in the front line, they can see how to make things better, right? So anyway, so that's the way I built a company from scratch to 180,000 employees, 40 billion in sales, right? Okay, so I became more philosophical and I said, so the message I want to get across is, I'd like to see Canada being the first country in the world, which part of its constitution would be an economic charter of rights. So the message I want to get across is, the human charter of rights alone is not sufficient. We have to fortify it with an economic charter of rights. Economic charters of rights will lead to economic democracies, and economic democracies are the basis for democracy itself. Let me put it in very simple, what I will call a grassroots language. All politicians agree, and all business people agree, if the economy doesn't work, nothing else will work. If the economy doesn't work, you cannot feed the hungry. You cannot look after the most fragile people, the elderly, the sick, and the handicapped. But we do not talk about the most important subject, the economy. It's the economy, the economy. So the message, again, I want to get across loud and clear is, without workers, you can't make a profit. So society's come to a long way, from the caveman to the hunter to the hunted, to the kings and the servants, and now we have bosses and unhappy employees. So the reason why I think I did so well is I treated the employees as partners. With the profit sharing, they became partners, right? So we done extremely well.
Yeah, the fair enterprise model in profit sharing seems to have stimulated and empowered employees, managers, and the community as well with the charitable aspects of what you do. At your age, young, 94 years young, you are in incredible shape, mentally, physically, spiritually. I'm curious how much the spirituality played in your fulfillment, your passion, your purpose, as well as your profitability. Have you utilized any type of spirituality or faith into empowering your success?
I'm not overly religious. I do believe in a higher being, right?
And me too. I believe in a higher being that loves me more than my mom. That's my simple. That's simple.
Sort of, mine too. You know, when we are young, we all want to hustle to make some money so that we can live in dignity and maybe help the family, you know. When I was 80, I looked in the mirror and said, Frank, you've been so blessed with good health, a good mind. And I'm saying, it doesn't matter how smart you are. When the stars are not aligned, things don't work. So when I was 80 years, I said, Frank, you've been missing a lot because over the years I gave lectures right from Harvard, right across the States, right across Canada, right across Europe, right? Because I built up over 400 factories in 34 different countries. So, but as I said earlier, I was on the boards of many universities. So when I looked in the mirror, I criticized myself and said, Frank, there's a lot of things you could have done. You didn't do anything innovative. You just went along what usually directors do. So what really is the mandate of a university? The mandate of a university is to teach young people how can we have a more civilized society. And I go even further. Universities would be ideal institutions which would work on structures which could lead to an ideal society, you know, because at this time, yes, we got great faculties in universities, great faculties in regards to medicine, technology, the arts, but very little in humanity. There's practically no blueprints which would lead to an ideal society. So when you get older, I think you need a mission, you need a purpose, you know, to be alive. And the message again, what I want to get across, we all could add, you know, depending on how well we do, we add to smaller purposes, larger purposes, big purposes, etc., etc. But you need a purpose to make sure, you know, can we improve? Can we have a more civilized society?
And a great objective and divine direction of a more civilized society. We also start later on in life diversifying. And to make those choices when you have extreme wealth, there's so many options, so many opportunities, so many touches of favor that exist. How did you determine how to diversify as you participated in entertainment, horse racing, real estate, and even organic farming? What was your decision-making process to decide where you were going to diversify throughout the years?
You see, for a while, for many years, I was the largest city landowner in America. I owned most of the horse racetracks, and the cities grew around.
Did you own Windsor?
No, I owned Los Angeles. You in California at Santa Anita, right?
Yeah.
And San Francisco, Golden Gates, right?
Yeah. Miami. My dad raced harness horses up at Windsor in Canada, so we had some exposure to horse racing.
So, but I owned pretty well most of the racetracks in the United States, Gulfstream Park in Miami, down
Del Mar. Did you own Del Mar?
No, Del Mar I didn't own, but I owned where we had the Triple Crown, the Preakness, right?
Yeah.
The more Pimlico, right? And Again, so part of it, when I bought Pimlico, on the one side of the racetrack is a middle-class Jewish community. Behind the racetrack is a black community, but with so much poverty, unbelievable, right? So one of those days, I asked, we had a lot of black security guards. I asked them, look, I want to go back and meet the neighborhood leaders, the black neighborhood leaders. So we went back and I saw a high school totally run down, deserted, right? I said to the community leaders, look, if you want to, with your help, I built it a most modern technical trade school. They were a little skeptical, and but 2 years later, when we opened up the school, some had tears in their eyes because I gave them tangible hope, where we taught young blacks how to accumulate knowledge in technology, business opening, etc., etc. So I've done a lot of things of that sort, right? And because again, basically, the key is how can we eliminate poverty? Because poverty leads crime, creates crimes, etc., etc. So that's one of the reasons I want to see an economic charter of rights. Right? Without there's no democracy without economic charters of rights. You ever heard of the Golden Rule?
Of course, I've heard of the Golden Rule. What's your Golden Rule?
No, there's only one golden rule.
Those who make money, what is it? It takes money to make money.
No. Who has the gold makes
the rules. Right. Who owns the gold makes the rules.
That's the golden rule. The world has always been dominated by the golden rule and still is. Yeah. You know, now the ruler, you don't see the rulers no more. The rulers might be in Hawaii, they might be in Beverly Hills, they might be in Monaco. So basically, the financial elite doesn't want to share the profits with the working class. That's the dilemma. So basically, we need a revolution, not a destructive revolution, a revolution of the mind, a civilized revolution to make things better, to eliminate poverty. And the economic charter of rights, you will eliminate poverty. And most of all, you know, if you're not economically free, you're not a free person, you're a slave. And it's a shame that so few people are economically free. What does it take to be economically free? If you make a statement, you gotta say, what are the minimum standards to be economically free? If an American man or woman or Canadian man or woman worked for 30 years, they should have accumulated that they own their house mortgage free. Or a condo mortgage free, and have at least $300,000 in their bank account to supplement their all their pensions. For the later years, they can choose their own road to happiness. How many do you know which fall in that category? And those are the minimum standards. An economic charter of rights would eliminate poverty, and would create the strongest middle class ever seen. I want to highlight one more thing.
Basically,
we have two economic culture coming up the road. One is the communistic culture, right? And my father was a communist. I had him over here once, and then he waffled because I told them, look, the socialistic philosophy, the communistic philosophies are based on wealth distribution. First, you got to create the wealth, otherwise there's nothing to distribute. So he kind of weakened a bit towards his later years, right? Okay, so, but anyway, so the communistic culture as practiced by, and I spent a lot of time with Putin, I could go into that too, and I've been to China. So basically 10% of the population in China and Russia are part of the military. Another 10% are the super bureaucrats. So basically have 20%, which tells 80% of the population don't cross the line or else. That means you have the freedom is stifled to quite a great extent, right? And we in America, Canada, we used to, freedom means everything. People died for freedom, right? So, but here the capitalistic system, I'm the last one, we should not destroy the capitalistic system. We want to make sure that it stays alive. So the part of the charter is that the capitalistic system could be totally practiced on the free enterprise under the capitalistic below 300 companies below 300 employees. And above 300 employees, then the capitalistic system needs harnessing. That means you got to share the profits with the workers, right? But below 300, that's pure free enterprise. Pure. When we look back about 50, 60, 70 years ago, America and Canada did great because small business was the backbone. Great ideas were developed by entrepreneurs, etc., etc. And we kind of kept killing that. They wrapped up in red tape and can't move. So we got to free small companies. Okay, below 300 employees. Okay, and they could practice without free enterprise. You cannot have free societies.
Which will be your legacy, the fair and free enterprise model. Which emphasizes the betterment for the employees, for investors, and society as a whole. Frank Stronach is a rags-to-riches phenomenon, and he is here with the purpose of changing the world and leaving a legacy, an economic legacy, of helping other people by making a lot of money for the sake of everyone. Frank Stronach, the founder of Magna International, a true entrepreneur. Thank you so much for joining me and sharing your playbook here with me, David Meltzer, on Entrepreneurs, the Playbook.